Z-Gram philosophy, I think, is very important that people understand, and it's something that the critics almost did not want to understand, but they used it as a very key point of their complaints about his methodology. He always had the reputation of being very action-oriented, of getting things done. When he saw a problem, he almost couldn't ignore it. He was inclined to, okay, how can we correct this? It's wrong, and what should be done to make it right? As we were in Vietnam, and he had this very close association with so many junior officers, and particularly junior enlisted personnel and senior enlisted personnel, he had the opportunity to see some of the things that were important to them and to get a feel for why they were not going to make a career in the Navy. Now, in country in Vietnam, you could understand why anyone would be disenchanted or might let their enlistment expire. But he made frequent visits out to the ships, and in that process always met with enlisted people, petty officers and junior officers, as well as the captain and staff officers. In those associations, he got a feel for some of their complaints, and they, one big category, which has been lumped into Mickey Mouse regulations, those things which to the enlisted personnel, they just did not see the reason for them. They felt that they were just regulations for the sake of regulations or for the benefit of an aggrandizement of the senior. And it was the Admiral's desire to examine all such regulations and try and do something about it. He did that in Vietnam to the maximum extent possible. And it was natural then that we became selected as CNO, one of our first tasks was to start to work on his agenda of what was to be accomplished. And he recognized that 4 years in the Washington arena was a very short time in which you could get things done. 48 months boils down into very short action periods. And in his visits with Admiral Admiral Burke, who was one of the first people that he visited, after the announcement, Admiral Burke told him, and it's recounted in On Watch, the fact that if you really want something done, you've got to go to the action officer who's responsible for it. You've got to know who's responsible for it, and you've got to keep track of that individual and the milestones. Are they being met? Well, that fell within the pattern then of what I had set up in Vietnam, his staff organization. For the staff organization, I think I mentioned once before that we found in Vietnam corporate memory is very short because of 12-month tours, and sometimes without good overlaps, decisions that he had made early somewhere got lost in the turnover and was not in the turnover file. It might have been in a too hard basket or something. So we set up the tracking system of the Green Stripers, which recorded the decision so that after a conference everyone knew what was the decision. And I don't know if you've come out of committee meetings and wondered, well, what was decided. It was almost as many views of that as those who were attending. And the purpose was, at least I put down what I saw the decision to be. Then we could take issue with that if you wanted to, but we were all talking from the same piece of paper. The Admiral could verify, you know, what the decision was. But then a specific person, and usually senior, the most senior was assigned, with that then were milestones required to be submitted of how you're going to get from here to there. Then this was just ideally suited with some modification to the Washington arena, and even more required. And we wound up finally getting it on computers so that we could do better tracking, sorting with database and spreadsheet. convenience. The the specific green stripes, we actually started Z-grams. We started drafting those ash green stripers on the way back from Vietnam. I can't remember our the yeoman that I've had a very fine first class, I wish I could remember his name right now, agreed to go back with us on the plane to delay his return home along with the rest of us that went. And I can seem to this day sitting in the back of the plane on a ration carton typing away and on a little portable typewriter turning out some of these things for the Admiral's consideration. Dave Halpern was along that we've mentioned before as being down at Seafloat, and he was going to be the one in charge of getting these focus groups together from the fleet, from shore bases, dependents, and representation to try and get a good cross-section of the fleet in various manageable groups of preferably not more than a dozen people in each one of those focus groups. And I think I previously described, didn't I, Les, how those would be, they would get together, they would have some briefings by the people in the Bureau of Naval Personnel as the predominant action bureau, who were explaining to them what the current budget problems were, what the policies were, and their justification for some of the regulations.
The focus groups were briefed in that manner?
The focus groups were briefed by these Bureau of Naval Personnel people so that they could hear from the experts then about the rules, regulations, and some of the problems of, you know, movement of household goods, why we couldn't reserve certain quarters and so forth. And he, Dave Halpern, was just superb at being able to distill these briefings, these discussions then that the focus group would have, who would come up with listings of items that they saw as problems that something ought to be done about. You know, it was a gripe list, and he tried to then convert that into some productive dialogue, which he was excellent at. He had a young assistant up in Connecticut.
Bill and Weegee Antle.
Bill Antle was lieutenant.
He was a JG then, was he not?
Right, I'm sure he was. Lieutenant JG William Antle, A-N-T-E-L-L, assisted Dave in that and then eventually took over when Dave went out of the Navy and went to law school. Both of them are millionaires now, I might say.
Wow.
Tremendously fine people and good junior officers.
Bill was president of his own company in Connecticut.
Those presentations were then roughed out by the committee, by the focus group, and with the assistance of Dave and Bill, were finally presented in their smooth form to the CNO and the SECNAV. Admiral Chick Rao usually was involved in pre-briefing those and helping them then with the final distillation. Those then, from the meeting of where they made their presentations to Admiral Jim Walt and the CNO, would flow a number of green stripes for the SECNAV and the CNO. From those would flow green stripes to the various seniors who would be responsible for responding. And there was not necessarily a directed action by the CNO or SECNAV at that time, but it gave the responsible senior a chance to make their case. From that then would result in a dialogue and probably subsequent briefings within OPNAV or Admiral Zumwalt, make his decisions, and then we would put out the decision, green striper, and that became the action to be tracked. It's understandable that there were a number of these decisions that were unpopular with old-timers particularly. An interesting aspect of those who complained, for instance, about sideburns and beards, the directive authorizing more liberal hair standards was actually signed by Admiral Tom Moore before Admiral Zumwalt was ever selected as CNO. And I think even Admiral Moore forgot about that in some of his later criticisms. But those were one of the things. Another typical example that the dependents brought up, I can still remember the young wife talking about, I loved him in his sailor suit, I married him in his sailor suit, I'm still proud of him in his sailor suit, but when we go in to a nice restaurant and he is in a dress blue uniform with his white Dixie cup and his neckerchief and so forth, and they tell us, I'm sorry, you cannot be permitted because coat and tie is required in this restaurant. And she said that's humiliating to somebody who's laid his life on the line and has maybe 10, 12, 14 years of service and all of these combat ribbons from Korea and Vietnam, perhaps. And she had tears in her eyes, and I think there were a few others of us that felt the same way. And that was the genesis of, hey, let's see what the fleet thinks about changing the uniform so that at least we'll get a feel for this. Well, there was a surprising percentage of officers and petty officers, chief petty officers, that were in favor of it. It was pretty close to a 50-50 sort of situation, and of course the enlisted personnel were very much in favor of it. Big problem was storage on board ship. Uniforms, the traditional uniforms, you could roll up, roll them up, put cord stoppers around them. You learn to do that in boot camp, and put them in a locker that was no bigger than half of the size of a foot locker with all of their other personal articles in them. Most of them then rented outside the gate a locker. There were many places called locker clubs that you could pay, and it was an exorbitant rate, whatever it was, because the enlisted personnel were not paid that well. But to be able to hang civilian clothes, be able to come in and change and go back aboard ship then in uniform, that was both an expense and it was exploited greatly, and it was a focus point for those who had other designs on those innocent, naive young enlisted men. So, first of all, how can we provide the storage space? That was a problem worked on, and you can always find place if you want to, but it took money, and it took time, and it took some initiative. The ships were able to work it out. It was not always the best. You had to have a group locker, maybe, where you could hang 50 coats, the blue coat that was developed very much like the chief petty officer uniform, and where you could put the hats that were more like the chief petty officer hats. There was opposition to it by the chiefs. There were a lot of them that understood the reason for the change, supported. There were a lot of them that said, hey, I worked 20 years to get this hat, and now a kid coming out of boot camp is going to be able to get it. Later, then after Admiral Zumwalt's term, the emphasis had shifted back, and that uniform went out, and we're back to the traditional uniform of one of the chief petty officers, wear the type of jacket and hat. But a few items like that became a focus of discontent and were used by his opposition to say how he was relaxing regulations. So the dungaree issue, being able to, another wife stood up and said how many pairs of whites she had to wash and iron so that he could ride in the car and go aboard the ship and come back home in white uniform, if that was the uniform of the day, and those whites had to be washed, because you cannot go around on a ship or a car or a bus without, you know, getting the smudge on them that immediately shows up where they would not show up on a pair of khakis, which the chiefs and the officers could wear. So it was, the Z-Gram was put out liberalizing the uniform that the, so long as they were clean dungarees and were to be used only going straight to or from work, and yes, they could stop at the gas station, yes, they could stop at the market, so long as that was done, but you don't go into the bar in dungarees, you don't do other recreational activity on the way home in dungarees. That greatly upset a lot of people and said, we've got a bunch of bums coming across the gangway now with beards and so forth and dirty dungarees out in public. The real issue, and this was later, Admiral Clary confirmed it, concerning the problems with race relations. The problem was not with the regulation. The problem was with the local commander not implementing them properly and with the spirit of it. There is a quarterdeck watch on every ship for every person that goes off that ship, should be seen for security reasons, if nothing else, to check baggage and for those who come aboard for the same reasons. Quarterdeck watch should enforce the regulation that that they shall be clean and presentable uniforms. The petty officers and officers ashore that would witness someone such as that who failed to get the identification of the individual and then report it to the local command. That is their responsibility also for good order and discipline. No one likes to be a roving cop, of course, if that's not his primary duty, and so it's very hard to expect them to do that function. But the control was at the base and the ship, and if those had been enforced, then you wouldn't have had so-called scraggly bums out on the street. They should be clean-shaven within the regulations of beards that were allowed and sideburns. And if they're growing beard, you don't go ashore until it looks like a decent beard. What is decent? Then any martinet could keep anybody ashore, or a ship, I mean, aboard ship, or the base forever because, you know, maybe he didn't like beards, period, and they all look scraggly. And so you got into those kinds of interpretations. But the reason that the Z-Grams went out was so that they would be self-policing. The Admiral knew the time that it takes for a directive that can be interpreted to go through the total chain of command, from the CNO, for instance, to sink pack fleet, and then down to the fleet commanders and the type commanders, and then to the ship commanders and unit commanders, and then finally get promulgated as a directive that you or I, the enlisted man, would see and enact upon it, is a very long time. We had to turn around the retention rates. As I mentioned, they were below 10% on reenlistments, first-term reenlistments. The technical ratings were even much lower than that. And on some of the aircraft carriers, because of their horrendous employment schedule of 10-month deployments to the Yankee Station off Vietnam, aircraft cycles around the clock, really physically grueling labor and dangerous anytime a flight deck's in operation is a hazardous place. The return to the States for 2 and 3 months and then dash right back. And then the cross-decking of personnel, some of those who came back from 10 months were transferred over to another ship that was about to deploy, and so they didn't even get their 3 months at home, and they were changed into a completely different environment of another ship and shipmates. And that was more demoralizing, to say the least, and had its impact on retention. The main objective of all of the Z-Grams was to improve the quality of Navy life so that we could retain the kind of people that were so essential, and especially in the knowing that the draft calls by the Army were going to end in the near future, and we had to get a product that would sell to the quality young people that we needed for the Navy of the future. And as he describes in On Watch, I think very, very well, that unless, no matter how much we modernize the fleet and how capable the weapons, new weapons are that we have, we will not be able to put the fleet to sea unless we have adequate and properly trained people to man it and the morale to sustain it. And on that basis then, many of these other things were done and represent really the probably 90% of the Seagram effort.
Common sense things.
That an anachronism was a word that was used, that they had long since reached the point where they were no longer required. Well, a lot of the traditionalists said you're deep sixing, you're getting rid of a lot of the naval history and traditions and customs that have made us the glorious service that we are. They had to be, in the Admiral's eyes, understandable as something that contributed to good order and discipline by the enlisted person and those required to enforce it, and of some use in accomplishing the mission. And that was his focus and parameters for operating on them. Now, I guess the biggest problems that were used were the racial incidents that occurred, and I think that's pretty well tracked in On Watch. And I won't take a lot of time to go into it, other than the fact that the requirement that Secretary McNamara came up with before Admiral Sumwalt became CNO on Admiral Tom Moore's watch as CNO was to take in, and it was some figure, and I have the figure, some 240,000 that the military required to take of the lower mental group 4 personnel. The categories of, based upon the Armed Forces qualification test, AFQT is what it was called in, as I recollect, was 4 different categories, and within those categories were subdivided. And mental group 4, of course, being the lower scores. And then there were jobs that could be done by the upper half of that mental group 4. The Army found, and that we found, there was no hope of them going to Class A school. The technical school was the fundamental advanced courses that would help them then have a future career and a reason for staying in the Navy. And the lower mental group 4s were actually considered unable to absorb the necessary information to complete a successful enlistment. There were disciplinary problems that have with those. They were not high school graduates generally, and there were significant problems. Now, the racial problems that happened in two of the carriers and one of the oilers were a group of minorities, I think in all three of those instances, who the basis of their discontent turned out to be, after many interviews, the inability to go on to an advanced school. And they saw Whitey going off to school and other people going off to school, but the large portion of the black minorities were not going to the advanced schools. It turned out that a significant number of these were part of that project 200,000 or whatever McNamara called it. It was strictly a social program on his part. Whether he intended it purely as a social program, or maybe it also aided and abetted to take some of the pressure off of the draft of college students and upper income people, I can't say, but it benefited both of his goals, if you can say the latter was one of them. It led then to this problem of a significant number of people who could not go to advanced schools who thought they were being discriminated against. And interestingly enough, those people were not brought into the Navy under some Walsh period. And yet he caught all of the flack, and it became a real congressional investigation that was both unfair in its approach, I think, and the report was grossly inaccurate in emphasizing the degree of the problem. Admiral Zumwalt recognized there was a racial problem. This is why he instituted so many of his programs to try and get equitable treatment for the minorities. Simple things like, do we have a barber that can cut the hair of those who have, because of their race, have different types of hair? You can't always be clean shaven simply because of some of the cosmetic dermatology problems that the minorities have, and this has to be taken into account, because requiring a person with that disorder can develop into a significant scarring problem. Cosmetics in the exchanges became a problem. We can't get the type of either hairdressing or cosmetics or the colors that the ladies want or the men want. And there was no reason why those things couldn't be corrected, and they were, but it was considered by many of the old-timers as sessions that were not necessary and were creating an atmosphere that the minorities were going to, be able to file complaints, as we now see in sexual harassment complaints. It is so easy for somebody to file a complaint, and then you find yourself defending against a negative, and it's a very difficult thing to do. Well, they foresaw some of those kinds of problems, some of which I guess were justified, but it was not done in a spirit of how can we solve the real underlying problem if we've got different cultures and ethnic preferences that can be accommodated without deteriorating good order and discipline. And so that's where the Admiral made tough calls and had to direct. And he knew that if he put out the Z-grams, it would be self-policing because they were required to be posted on all bulletin boards, except very few that were classified. And immediately the troops knew what the commander was supposed to be implementing. And I see a lot of similarity in that in what my son has now put out as his command philosophy. It was so that the crew would know what he expects of them, and in turn it publicizes what they can expect of him, that he will expect of them. Both sides know where the other one's coming from, and it makes it a lot easier to comply with your mission when you know what the boss expects of you. And in turn, when you know what he expects of you. Then led to the charges that he was bypassed, that Admiral Zumwalt was bypassing the chain of command. And he acknowledged later that we could have done a better job of cutting him in advance, but still be able to publicize and get the direct action.
So it was putting these directives on a bulletin board that everyone could see that led to the accusation that the chain of command is somehow being bypassed.
Right. Correct.
Okay. And
instead of the step-by-step, dribble down, which is proper when you're putting out new policy, where timeliness is not as critical as the Admiral felt it was to get the situation turned around. If you have a first-class petty officer of a technical rating, or even a four-year man who is an ideal candidate for a Navy career that you want to keep in, that shows leadership potential and advancement in the technology and the capability to go on to higher schools. If you've got that four-year man, you know, he's making his decisions either 12 months and at the latest maybe 6 months from now, that's going to committing to the path of either going out or staying in. And the Admiral wanted them to know there are better days coming. We are going to change. We're still going to be a proud and a capable and a Navy of good order and discipline. But things that can be changed, we're going to do so. And with that, it offered hope to a lot of these people. And we saw a significant turnaround with a watch and wait attitude by those that otherwise would have lost. And he sacrificed perhaps the support of many of those intermediate commanders. Some of them used it as a crutch instead of taking the hard stand and making them work, as Admiral Cleary said we should have. They didn't, and they simply passed the buck and said, all right, if he wants to run it from Washington, let him do it. He wasn't trying to run it from Washington. He was giving them wider authority, such as authority on when to change uniform, the uniform of the day, taking it out of some distant person's hands. Why should we in Washington decide what you're going to wear in Pensacola? Things of this nature. So he was trying to give the commanding officers wider authority, many of those directives. But the ones that didn't want to carry them out found reasons not to, and were ultimately those that had some of the most significant problems. Because anytime you are not showing an obvious support by the superior's orders, not only is it disloyal and even intentionally subverting the goals that he's trying to achieve, you're creating your own problems too in even greater dissent. And that's what those commanders resented and said was the fault of Admiral Zumwalt.
How much of that do you think was deliberate? Do you think there was a lot of deliberate avoidance of carrying out the policies that were
there was, and how widespread was it? There's no way you can measure that. I think based on surveys of and the data are in Admiral Zumwalt's book on watch of the numbers that came back of whether or not they supported the program, the overall program, were surprisingly high. And the other surprise were the number of senior petty officers and officers that did support it. And of course, it was not as high as those immediately impacted, the junior enlisted and the junior officers. But there was intentional foot drag, and that was the reason he had to continue the Z. Graham approach of putting them out, and the Green Striper approach at the senior level of tracking and getting implementation of the directives that were necessary to then expand on the Z. Grahams.
One of the criticisms I've seen, which one of your statements reminded me, I have read where officers, commanding officers, complained that they found, after some of the Z-grams had been disseminated, they found it difficult to maintain discipline aboard ship because they would bring a sailor before the mast and the sailor would say, well, I don't have to do that because the CNO Z-grams say that I don't. And I wondered about that. What would your reaction to that?
I'd have to investigate each individual case. Could you, as a commanding officer, knowing what the Z-Graham policy and directive was, intentionally violate it, or have you found a loophole, or was there an honest disagreement of opinion? Now, anyone who would stand up and make that kind of a statement could also be guilty of insubordination and as a minimum, discourtesy. But I suspect it was something like, it was my understanding that Z. Graham up and down permitted me to do this. Then it becomes a question of interpretation. And it's strictly a matter of leadership, of how an individual commanding officer approaches those kinds of problems. And I never knew myself of a specific incident, but that's my fault. I wasn't in that chain that had those kind of things come forward. I heard reports of that, but never could they give me specifics. You know, what ship was this? What CO can I contact to find out about it? Well, there are a lot of them and so forth, and there were reasons why they wouldn't give them to you. It's just like when I took the recruiting command, to divert to that a little bit, I would go out and talk to the fleet commanders, the COs of ships, and get complaints about quality of some of the recruits that came. I got approval for a message to come in direct from the fleet to recruiting with info to Chief of UPERS and CNO on specific cases by name of an individual that they had received that they thought was not worthy of having initially been recruited and retained in the Navy. We would then be able to track that back to the recruiter that signed the papers that brought him into the Navy. And in that way, we had accountability of, but the main thing was it cut out a lot of these people who said, we can't do anything about this trash you're sending to us. Okay, report the trash to me, give me the specifics, and we'd take action on it. We got some messages on that. And I mean, it was not hundreds by any means. It was maybe a dozen a month at the most. It improved both recruiting, but it also eliminated a lot of these terrible rumors. The same thing was true, I think, of the complaints that were picked up. We can't do anything to discipline our sailors because of the orders you put out. Either they weren't reading the orders right, or they didn't give a damn and weren't trying to improve the Navy and the quality of leadership.
That raises a question in my mind, in terms of the way the Z-grams themselves are written. I've read a couple of them, but do you think from an operational standpoint, when these are actually disseminated down to the fleet, do you think that there was ever a problem in the way that they were written where there could be misinterpretation, or an officer might find a loophole, and there was some problem as to how you could understand the order and carry it out in those terms?
If we could ever write perfectly, we wouldn't have any need for lawyers, would we?
That's a good point.
You know, even the greatest of brains in our, they're writing the laws that study them for months and debate them for months, and then they're written and they wind up in the courts. So any directive can be misunderstood unless you really want to carry out the spirit of the policy.
One would think that a CO, before he put something on his bulletin board, would read it.
Mm-hmm. And come to some.
Right.
It's a question of, and I have to answer yes. Some of the directives were written in haste. Certainly those early ones we put out without an appreciation for the ramifications of the ego of individuals and the feelings and even the impact that it could have on discipline if the CO and the unit commander didn't understand and wasn't willing to understand. And this is what Admiral Sumwalt's getting at. We could have done a better job of informing the senior chain of command, and later inevitably he would go out to the sinks, the four-star level, and say, this is a policy that's coming out that I am planning to put out. I invite your comments. And there would come in comments, and he would take those into consideration. And some of them, even though the Z-gram might have gone out then, he would modify. You'll see some of them that were amended or clarified.
That raises an interesting question, what you said about some of the initial Z-grams being done in haste. So could this be an example of Admiral Sumwalt and his staff having an initial enthusiasm to hit the ground running and begin making these changes immediately, right, before they can perceive what what effect that might have.
Right. And I've visualized that so many times as I see new administrations come in, either Chief of Naval Operations or the President, new staffs being formed and suddenly new initiatives coming out that then are not warmly received by the 100% of the population, and particularly those they impact on. And I've recognized at that time that we were operating in a feeling of euphoria of how we were going to accomplish many good things to help a lot of good people, particularly coming from Vietnam and feeling that our sailors had earned consideration as mature citizens and adults and should be treated like that because of what we had seen them display in great courage and as well as decision-making ability at all levels. We were, I guess, a little bit naive, maybe. Mm-hmm. And you consider the, again, vast amount of things that were taking place, both for the Admiral having to absorb, as well as the number of people that you were being subjected to on all sides for various reasons. And by this I mean both their own ideas, well-intentioned, there's a tugging and a pulling. There are people who have their own axe to grind. You immediately didn't realize how many friends you always had that you never knew before. People would come to me and wanting me to put in a word for them, for the Admiral, for a position on the staff. Significant number of people that first week that we were back in the Pentagon for and available for the Admiral's appointments for briefings in that were scheduled by Admiral Moore. But there were so many people came seeking for their own good. But there were many, many who were, the effort was not self-serving.
What can I do to help?
Yeah, and who had good ideas, and some of which were used, and some of them were put to work on them, too.
I want to ask you about this initial period, beginning perhaps with coming back from Saigon on this round-the-world tour. It seems to me that if Admiral Zumwalt and the staff are already beginning to germinate and produce these initial directives, what that tells me that the Admiral already had in mind at least a skeletal plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so how early did he begin thinking about this, even before he knew he would be CNO or?
These were things that, yes, that came up back from the time he was a very junior officer in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there, as Muggs had mentioned a while ago, there were practical things. And he and I used to discuss some of the surveys and discoveries that people had made that were that we should consider for human consideration, leadership elements that were being taught in school and classes. And we would look at each other and say, you know, those were fundamental things as a division officer that we used to do that were that would improve morale and performance and such as this, that we thought were second nature for people who considered themselves leaders or found themselves in position of leadership. But yet, that is not true. Some people can become good students of leadership techniques and others do have a certain, I think it's through their human compassion perhaps, are better leaders than others, but we can all learn to be better leaders, and that was what he was trying to ensure. So I think the genesis of much of it started with his early career in the Navy.
Yes.
And things that he had seen proven, and he found that he could place trust and confidence in men. And in Vietnam, he found that no matter what the objection and demonstrations were back home, he had quality people volunteering to do hazardous jobs when A, they knew what the mission was, B, they knew the purpose of it, and C, they were convinced that it was for a worthy cause, and that comes from overall from good leadership. It's a different generation. You no longer just say, squatch right and march over the cliff. You have to be sure they know that what the purpose of the mission is and what they're trying to accomplish, and hopefully be able, because it is a good mission, be able to tell them what it's going to achieve and the so what's the reason for taking the risk. Those things I think he saw vividly as he went through three wars and then came back to the States faced with a new generation with new outlooks, and himself having young children growing up all the way from the two of them that fought in the war to the two girls who were still maturing.
Mm-hmm. What was the process on this trip? Did Admiral Zumwalt say, I want to take action here, here, and here, or did he sit down with a group that might include you and say, now let's think about this and how can we begin implementing this?
I think the easy thing is to say it was a combination of that. It was highly informal because we always operated very informally. A topic of discussion might come up at the headquarters in Vietnam at the breakfast table, as I mentioned, which was frequently the action hour of the day, you might say. How better to describe it than that it would be a point brought up. It could be by any member of the staff, perhaps, or an observation of the admiral that he would throw out for